Welcome to Gun and Country Radio. Weekend program discusses current social, political, economic, and prophetic events in the light of biblical theology. I'm your host, Pastor Brad Winship. This week's program is a rerun. 15 years ago, when I started these weekly programs, I did a program about free trade versus protectionism, program number 21. I've always been interested in economics because there's a great moral spiritual component in regard to how people use their money, which is a point Jesus made continually. Matthew chapter 6, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Or Luke 16, if you're unfaithful and unrighteous mammon, how can God entrust you true riches? And then there's the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. In regard to free trade, policymakers in promoting cheap foreign slave labor have sold the store. They've destroyed American businesses and have hurt the American worker. They're the foolish shepherds who do not care for the flock. They are the sinners who destroy much good. But finally, we have an administration that understands the fallacies that have been taught in regard to free trade. And now there is a systemic shift in economic thought. Those of us who are warning about the dangers of free trade and the fallacies of comparative advantage were voices crying in the wilderness. But now people are beginning to see the truth, which is the way all truth is gradually received. So without any further introduction, here is my program from 15 years ago.
1976 was the first year America imported more than she exported, resulting in the beginning of an expanding national trade deficit. In 2008, the trade deficit was about $700 billion. That means we bought $700 billion more than we sold. In 2009, the economic downturn dropped the deficit to $400 billion, but that was still awful. You don't have to be an economist to know that these numbers are alarming. And you know something is wrong when it's almost impossible to find a product made in America in any of the major department stores. Everyone knows that that is unsustainable. Any nation that consumes more than it produces is destined for trouble. A trade deficit represents national debt and foreign ownership of American enterprise. Dollars abroad are promissory notes guaranteeing the future ownership of American labor and resources. No matter how much positive spin economists put on trade deficits, the biblical principle is never sidestepped. Proverbs 22:7, the rich rules over the poor, and the borrower becomes the lender's slave. In the Mosaic Law, God describes the nation that is righteous and blessed of the Lord as having a trade surplus. For the Lord your God will bless you as he promised you, and you will lend to many nations, but you will not borrow. And you will rule over many nations, but they will not rule over you. Deuteronomy chapter 15. Also in Deuteronomy chapter 28, the Lord will open for you his good storehouse. The Lord will make you the head and not the tail. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. You will be above and you will not be underneath if you listen to the commandments of the Lord your God. The corollary is that there is a curse that comes upon a disobedient nation, and that can be measured in a national trade deficit. Deuteronomy chapter 28 goes on to lay out the curse that will come upon the unrighteous nation. And the consequence is not only deficits, but the ultimate deficit. Foreigners will occupy your country and begin to take rule. Deuteronomy 28:33, a people who you do not know shall eat up the produce of your ground and all your labors, and you will never be anything but oppressed and crushed continually. The alien who is among you shall rise above you higher and higher, but you will go down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you will not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you will be the tail. So it should distress any leader in America that the Bible itself says that our trade deficit is a curse and a sign that we have departed from God. But there is a lesson I want the Christian to learn from all this. When a nation departs from God, the leaders of the nation become intellectually blind and do the very thing that destroys the nation, all the while they believe they are doing the nation good. They sell a store. So that in the end, men cannot point their finger at God for bringing the destruction, but they must say, we did it to ourselves. In the 20th century, when America departed morally and spiritually from God, for some unseen reason, all of her economists began to teach the virtue of free trade, that trade deficits are okay, maybe even a good thing. And the economists of our day are not alarmed by the teaching of Deuteronomy chapter 28. They don't even know the teaching of Deuteronomy chapter 28, nor do they see economics through a biblical worldview. Instead, they are led astray by the ever-changing fads of economic theory. And it's remarkable how well-educated economists develop sophisticated mathematical models that advise national leaders to take the very course of action that sells America. I sat in classrooms and heard all the theories of free trade being taught as fact. And if you disagreed because you understood there were higher nationalistic and moral values to be considered, you were considered a backward Neanderthal. But this is exactly what the scriptures teach. When a nation goes astray spiritually, departing from the word of God, the people will follow the wrong counsel. Let me give you some quick examples of this. The Old Testament is filled with examples of how God undermines a wicked people with foolish counselors. 2 Samuel chapter 17, for the Lord had ordained to thwart the good counsel of Ahithophel, so that the Lord might bring calamity on Absalom. 2 Chronicles 10, Rehoboam providentially adopted the wrong economic advice so that God would judge Israel. 2 Chronicles 25, 16. The prophet of God says to King Amaziah, I know that God has planned to destroy you because you have done this and you have not listened to my counsel. Jeremiah chapter 19, verse 7. I will make void the counsel of Judah and Jerusalem in this place, and I will cause them to fall by the sword before their enemies. Ezekiel chapter 7, verse 26. Disaster will come upon disaster. They will seek a vision from the prophet, but the law will be laws from the priest and counsel from the elders. Hosea chapter 10, verse 6, and Israel will be ashamed by its own counsel. The prophets to the kings of the ancient world were the king's counselors. Religion was combined with all areas of life. The prophets in America in our day are her economists, because America worships at the altar of the almighty dollar. And American counselors have led her down the path of decline, thinking all the while that they're helping the nation. Your job is outsourced overseas to someone who makes 50 cents an hour. I know of machine shops that have closed down because there's no way they can compete with Chinese products. They can't even buy the raw materials for the price of Chinese finished goods. And you ask, why is America doing this to herself? Well, the United States did not fully practice free trade until 1933. From the beginning of our country, tariffs ranging from 35% to 50% were put on foreign goods. Why? Well, to favor domestic manufacturing so that an industry base could be built here in the United States, and to protect American wages by not having to compete with cheap foreign labor, which is often unjust slave labor. Protectionism was the philosophy in early America. And even though Adam Smith, in his book, The Wealth of Nations, which was published in 1776, taught that free trade was the best policy, the leaders in America were not convinced. America was a sovereign nation, a family that needed to look out after itself and buy and sell in the family. And American protectionism actually worked very well. America was large enough to produce what she needed, and the tariffs collected from foreign products paid for most of the expense of the federal government. There was no need for an income tax. But beginning with Franklin Roosevelt, the new economic fad was free trade. Part of the reason for this change was the populace's desire for cheap products. Definitely a short-sighted policy, not realizing that in the end, the manufacturing base of our country is hurt. But also, there was a spirit of globalism, a desire to be international. And the policymakers at this time actually believed that free trade would help bring about world peace. As if you do not attack people you do business with. But in the end, I really believe free trade does the opposite, and it will be a cause for war. Economists produce all sorts of sophisticated mathematical models, which concluded that if one country trades with another country, the wealth of both countries is increased. But in actuality, research into the benefit of free trade is inconclusive. Most of the conclusions are based on wrong assumptions regarding how people behave, assumptions which work well on paper but do not hold true in the real world. And there is a very good body of research that actually concludes that in real-life situations, free trade hurts more countries than it helps. But what is more important is that what is called free trade is not biblical economic policy. That may surprise you because it's assumed that everyone who is conservative or on the Christian right is for free trade. The Republican Party is for free trade, and the Democratic Party, while outwardly saying that they are against free trade to appease the unions, are actually 100% for free trade. It was Bill Clinton who signed NAFTA into law. The only recent politician who came out against free trade was Ross Perot. We all remember him saying that giant sucking sound you hear is American jobs going overseas. Ross Perot is mocked as being unsophisticated, a throwback from the past, an evil protectionist. I believe most Americans support the concept of free trade because they hear the word free. And being liberty-loving Americans, we tend to believe that the best policy must be freedom to buy whatever we want from whatever country we want. And in general, the alternative put forth to free trade is government intervention, which always sounds bad. And we are safer trusting the free markets than the bureaucrats. And many conservatives believe that the economic Bible is Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, written in 1776. In that book, Smith taught free trade and laissez-faire economics, that if every man works for his enlightened self-interest, we would all be benefited, and that the economic laws of supply and demand will result in justice. By the way, Adam Smith was not a Christian man. He was a good friend of the atheist humanist David Hume. And Smith, in his economic theories, set out to create a system of economics based upon human reason. Like all those in the Enlightenment, they sought to discard biblical authority for some other method. And I believe that Adam Smith-style free capitalism is generally right, but it creates social problems where it digresses from biblical law. In unrestrained capitalism, the forces of the marketplace, man's supply and demand, are regarded as the sole arbiter of man's economic behavior. But the Bible teaches that man's desires, even man's economic desires, are not always right and must be regulated by the state. Might does not make right. Economic decisions must be first made through biblical ethics and second by supply and demand. And it takes sanctified wisdom to know how to apply and balance this in every given situation. But you cannot monopolize in an industry. Isaiah chapter 5 says this. You cannot pay a worker for what you can get him for. Deuteronomy chapter 24 teaches that you may have the economic power to oppress the poor and needy with low wages, but it's against the law of God. Just because it is in the power of your hand to do something economically does not mean it is lawful. Micah chapter 2, woe to those who scheme iniquity, who work out evil on their beds. When morning comes, they do it, for it is in the power of their hand. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They rob a man of his house and a man of his inheritance. So the philosophy that if everybody works in their enlightened self-interest, everything will be okay, is not a biblical philosophy. As Christians, we do not believe that whatever a man does with his money will result in prosperity and justice. It's not right for every man to do what is right in his own eyes. God's moral law needs to be imposed upon the activities of men, especially in the area of business. Now, what about free trade? The Christian economic philosophy should be called nationalistic moral free trade. There are some biblical moral guidelines that teach us free trade needs to be limited by the state if it threatens the industry or sovereignty of a nation, for God made national distinctions, if cheap foreign goods are produced by slave labor, or if the policy sends wealth overseas. And these principles were colonial America's justification for protectionism. In 1976, the first year there was a trade imbalance, the leaders of America should have returned to the policies of our forefathers. But remember, God was allowing their delusion, for an ungodly nation will borrow from many nations and not lend. A picture is worth a thousand words, so let me illustrate this with a story. There's a farmer who has a large family. This is Farmer Number One. Farmer Number One has tried to build and protect his wealth by doing most of the work on the farm himself. An advocate for free trade tells Farmer Number One that any smart farmer will never attempt to make at home what it will cost him more to make than to buy. So rather than making everything at home, he should buy products made by his neighbor. In economic fairyland, Farmer One trades with Farmer Two, and they both prosper. But let me tell you how it happens in the real world, where real human beings are involved. Farmer One has worked hard to build a farming business. Farmer Two, next door, works in his own self-interest and wants more power and more wealth than his neighbor. In fact, he would like to take over Farmer One's farm and Farmer One's wealth. So Farmer Two manufactures alcohol, trinkets, well-advertised designer suits, hoping that by selling to Farmer One, he can gradually whittle away Farmer One's wealth. The sons of Farmer One get lazy, and rather than making clothing and trinkets in their own shop, they find it easier to spend their father's hard-earned accumulated money on the products made by Farmer Two. The sons get so lazy that they decide to sell the tractor and hire Farmer Two to plow the farm. With the machinery sold and the skill of plowing lost, the sons of Farmer One can't easily change this arrangement. The sons of Farmer One keep buying services and products from Farmer Two until they have sent all of their dollars over to Farmer Two in the form of huge trade deficits. In the short term, it seems like Farmer Number One's sons have the life of luxury. But all of a sudden, there are problems on Farm Number One. There is not enough money to go around. There is piggy bank failures and unemployment. The free trade economist comes along and says, well, that's no problem. Farmer Two has to eventually do something with all of the dollars he has earned from Farmer Number One. He will eventually start to buy products from Farmer Number One and his sons. But in real life, Farmer Number Two is smart. He doesn't buy products from Farmer Number One. He buys up Farmer Number One's tractors and land. He bankrupts Farmer Number One, buys up the farm, and rehires the farmer's sons as indentured servants. The economic reality is that one neighbor becomes rich by producing, and the other neighbor becomes poor by consuming. In Luke chapter 15, Jesus tells the story of the prodigal son, who wastefully engages in free trade out of greed and laziness. Luke 15, verse 13, the younger son gathered everything together and went on a journey into a foreign country, and there he squandered his estate with loose living. What economists can't work into their formulas is that there is such a thing as national laziness and selling out. Through production, China has earned trillions of American dollars. But they're smart. Rather than reciprocating and purchasing depreciating American trinkets, they purchase American debt and American businesses, therefore securing for themselves a steady stream of income from the American taxpayer. The borrower is a slave to the lender. In capitalism, there can be illegal predatory practices whereby one industry engages in activities to put their competition out of business, practices such as selling below the cost, dumping, seeking unfair wage advantages, monopolization. If a company can put the competition out of business, it knows that it will have a competitive advantage for decades. They know that it's almost impossible to rebuild the intellectual and financial capital that's been lost. countries do the same to each other. Free traders fail to realize that in every foreign exchange, nations seek to engage in predatory practices. They do not sell cars to foreign nations simply for the price of the car. They want to dominate the industry and gradually and secretly put the foreign country out of the car-making business. They want the politicians of the other country to buy into the philosophy of laissez-faire free trade so that these useful idiots will actually believe they're creating wealth when they're actually selling the farm. Those who are naive to this die. Those who practice it conquer. A country is a sovereign entity created by God to function independently of other nations. And it must look out after its national self-interests, even as the fatherly farmer must make sure to keep the wealth in his family. He must do this even if it means producing things at home that appear to cost him more to make than to buy. The ethic overlooked by the free trade economist is God's purpose for the nations. National self-interest must be maintained, and it's no surprise that free trade capitalists are increasingly supporting globalism. Given all I know about what the Bible says about economics, if the leaders of our country want to turn America around economically, we ought to cut the size of government by one-third, cut the corporate income tax and replace it with tariffs on all imported goods. All those jobs that the administration says will never come back to America will immediately come back. There will be full employment and the elimination of the budget deficit. Sure, there would be international protests, but these other nations would be better served by making products for their own people. And sure, the dollar store would now be the $2 store. But is it right to have people make for us products for 50 cents an hour when we demand that American businesses pay minimum wage of $7.25 an hour? But this plan of returning to the protectionism of early America will never come to the mind of our nation's current leadership. In fact, I believe the right plan to revive America economically is reserved for a godly government. Until America turns back to God and returns to implementing biblical principles in our national policy, our leaders will never discover how to fix our national problems. The Word of God tells us that when a nation is ungodly, the counsel of the wise men will be void and vision will be lost. But as it is, the world is following the theories of the economists. The spirit of the age is internationalism, and in that, the world is not listening to God. God is planning to judge the nations by their own policies. Now, some at this point might say, well, who cares about American prosperity? Our kingdom is not of this world. Our reward is not earthly. Why should we be interested in the economic prosperity of America? Well, our kingdom is not of this world, but we are called to do good unto all men and to give good counsel to the world when they seek our advice. We want to show them how they can live prosperously. The Christian is concerned for the physical well-being of his neighbor. The Good Samaritan helped the poor man out of a ditch. We work to proclaim the ways of the Lord. Isaiah chapter 58, cry aloud, do not hold back. Raise your voice like a trumpet and declare to my people their transgressions.
So that concludes my program about free trade from 2010. When we discuss God's truth, economic or otherwise, it's just as relevant today as it was centuries ago. Now, to conclude, I want to share the audio of J.D. Vance speaking in New York City at the Waldorf to a group of American business leaders. This was on March 18th, where he explained the failures of globalization and free trade. Vance was explaining this even before Trump instituted the tariffs. This is a 4-minute clip.
There were two conceits that our leadership class had when it came to globalization. The first is assuming that we can separate the making of things from the design of things. The idea of globalization was that rich countries would move further up the value chain while the poor countries made the simpler things. You would open an iPhone box and it would say designed in Cupertino, California. Now, the implication, of course, is that it would be manufactured in Shenzhen or somewhere else. And yeah, some people might lose their jobs in manufacturing, but they could learn to design or, to use a very popular phrase, learn to code. But I think we got it wrong. It turns out that the geographies that do the manufacturing get awfully good at the designing of things. There are network effects, as you all well understand. The firms that design products work with firms that manufacture. They share intellectual property, they share best practices, and they even sometimes share critical employees. Now, we assumed that other nations would always trail us in the value chain, but it turns out that as they got better at the low end of the value chain, they also started catching up on the higher end. We were squeezed from both ends. Cheap labor is fundamentally a crutch, and it's a crutch that inhibits innovation. I might even say that it's a drug that too many American firms got addicted to. Now, if you can make a product more cheaply, it's far too easy to do that rather than to innovate. And whether we were offshoring factories to cheap labor economies or importing cheap labor through our immigration system, cheap labor became the drug of Western economies. And I'd say that if you look in nearly every country from Canada to the UK that imported large amounts of cheap labor, you've seen productivity stagnate. And I don't think that's not a total happenstance. I think that the connection is very direct. Now, one of the debates you hear on the minimum wage, for instance, is that increases in the minimum wage force firms to automate. So a higher wage at McDonald's means more kiosks. And whatever your views on the wisdom of the minimum wage, I'm not going to comment on that here. Companies innovating in the absence of cheap labor is a good thing. I think most of you are not worried about getting cheaper and cheaper labor. You're worried about innovating, about building new things, about the old formulation of technology is doing more with less. You guys are all trying to do more with less every single day. And so I'd ask my friends, both on the tech optimist side and on the populist side, not to see the failure of the logic of globalization as a failure of innovation. Indeed, I'd say that globalization's hunger for cheap labor is a problem precisely because it's been bad for innovation. Both our working people, our populace, and our innovators gathered here today have the same enemy. And the solution, I believe, is American innovation. Our capacity to create new innovation in the economy cannot be a race to the bottom. Now, America's not going to win the future by ditching child labor laws or paying our workers less than Chinese or Vietnamese laborers. We don't want that, and it's not on the table. We can only win by doing what we always did, protecting our workers and supporting our innovators and doing both of those things at the same time. And so, I want to talk a little specifics here. The Trump administration's great plan for staging the great American manufacturing comeback is simple. You're making interesting new things here in America? Great. Then we're going to cut your taxes, we're going to slash regulations, we're going to reduce the cost of energy so that you can build, build, build. Our goal is to incentivize investment in our own borders, in our own businesses, our own workers, and our own innovation. We don't want people seeking cheap labor. We want them investing and building right here in the United States of America.
So the encouragement in this is that J.D. Vance understands the issues, and he falls on the right side. He saw firsthand what open trade did to families in Ohio. We know it took 40 years to get into this economic mess, and it's going to take years to dig ourselves out. After Trump's term, if Democrats win, or if the typical Republican wins, America will go right back to shipping all industries offshore for the sake of short-term profits. But if by God's hand of providence, J.D. Vance becomes president from 2028 to 2036, economically, America has a good chance of going in the right direction. Well, thanks for listening. God's word truly changes the way we live, even when it comes to financial decisions. May Jesus Christ reign.